Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This podcast comes live from the Latitude Festival, where just recently I did an onstage Kermode on Film with a brilliant selection of guests. Coming up on the show, poet laureate Simon Armitage, Deborah Francis White, the guilty feminist, and Richard Curtis, writer of the current hit release, Yesterday. So sit back and enjoy Kermode on Film live from Latitude. Oh, and a word of warning, this episode contains some, well, let's be honest, a lot of strong language.
We have a fully packed show today. It's an extra long one. So I want a lot of excitement in the room. I want to get some applause going from now. Get it, build it nice and low so that the mics get ready for it. And a big cheer as I welcome to the stage Kermode on Film, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello, everybody. How are you all doing?
Hello.
Oh, good. We're lively this morning. Are you all enjoying Latitude, having a good time?
Yes.
How many of you have been bitten in very awkward places by mosquitoes? I currently have a mosquito bite on the side of my face, and it makes me look like that picture of Steve Bannon that somebody said looked like Steve Bannon had a rat crawling up inside his head. So we have a packed show for you today. We have three fabulous guests. The whole thing will be available to download from all your usual places, Acast, iTunes, however you do it. So let's start by welcoming to the stage, I can't believe I'm saying this, I'm so thrilled, poet laureate Simon Armitage. Okay, so theoretically, this discussion will revolve around film, but there will be other things we'll be doing as well. Firstly, Simon, because this is the first time I've seen you since you were... What is the phrase? Laureated?
Let's go with that.
Okay. Yeah. So it's the first time I've seen you since you were laureated. What happened? Was there a ceremony? Did you get a hat? Was there a gown? Did somebody with a sword do something? Did you meet the Queen?
I did meet the Queen, yeah.
You sound thrilled about that.
I was very thrilled. It was very exciting. It was sort of fairy tale stuff. Well, there's a whole series of backstage goings on, and then that culminates, I understand, after a series of letters and recommendations between the powers that be and the powers that be. The Prime Minister rings up and offers you the post. So that was...
So you got called by the Prime Minister?
I did, yeah. I was trying to remember which one it was. It was Theresa May. So that was 6 or 7 weeks ago.
Stupid question. Were you expecting the call? Or were you like at
home? Was I in the shower? That's what you're asking. Yeah. No, I'd been told to expect the call, and it got put back a couple of times. I think she was quite busy. I've heard people talk about this before. The phone rings and somebody's on the line saying the next voice that you'll hear will be the Prime Minister's voice, and it was the Prime Minister, and she was very chatty, and we engaged in conversation about geography, because we're both geography graduates, I think. So I got the impression that it was probably the most enjoyable thing that she'd had to do that week.
Did you ask her how things were going for her? Did you say, you know, enough about me, what about you?
I knew how things were going for her. I think it was the week before she officially stepped down. But it was an interesting conversation because she made it clear that the laureateship, there's no actual job really. It's very much down to the individual. So up until Ted Hughes, the last lifetime laureate, and after Ted died, then it became a decade long tenure, and I'm just embarking on that journey now.
So you've got 10 years as being the poet laureate, and for those who don't know, which probably includes me, what exactly does it involve doing? You're an ambassador for poetry. You have to write. There are certain things that you have to write for certain events.
Well, there are no obligations whatsoever, but that doesn't mean to say that there aren't any expectations. Okay. So it's always been a role that's been associated with writing for occasions, some of which have been royal occasions, others more recently with recent laureateships have been sort of big public national events and so on and so forth. But in some ways I've been doing that anyway for the best part of 30 years. I've always seen myself as a public poet trying to engage with things that are going on in the everyday world. So I'm hoping that I'm not going to have to break stride too much on that front. And then the thing that people seem to know most about or be most interested in is the sherry. There's a gift of sherry. Yeah, I suddenly found that I've got a lot of sherry drinking friends. Yeah, it's a butt of sack. Not a sack of butt. I think that might be something quite different. Yeah, a butt, which is a barrel of sack, which is a particular kind of sherry. And back to the original laureate, or some people say that he was the first laureate, John Dryden. Back then, there was an official arrangement between the Crown of Spain and the Crown of Britain, and the sherry was actually part of the payment. And then I think in about 1790. There was a poet called Henry James Pye who decided that he didn't want the sherry, he wanted the money instead. He's probably a Yorkshireman. I can say that. And so he got the money. I don't know whether it's £27 or £270. And the whole thing fell into abeyance. And then it was reinstituted in with Ted Hughes in the 1980s.
As sherry rather than as money.
Yeah, and so you're invited up to Jerez in Spain to choose your barrel, and to choose your barrel, and they write your name on it, and it's 750 bottles.
And have you done it yet?
No, October. So.
So in October you're going to go to Spain to write your name on a barrel of sherry.
It's harder work than that. I have to go around tasting them first. To decide which ones I like, and and then I think they—I don't know the official term—decant off 75 bottles a year and send them over. And previous laureates have used them as gifts and as ways of raising money,
right,
or just to get pickled over 10 years.
Was there any part of your childhood self that could ever imagine this situation?
No. No, I mean, absolutely not. And that would be something I would share with most of my teachers as well, I think.
Are you still in touch with any of your teachers?
I am, actually, yeah. And I'm giving a kind of homecoming read in Huddersfield. Homecoming, I still live there.
Homestaying.
Yeah, okay. Homestaying reading, yeah. And I'm hoping that they're going to come along. And like most people that you speak to, particularly people who write, they have very fond memories of particular teachers who were very encouraging about literature and so on and so forth. And that's true in my case.
When you got the Poet Laureate, for which I take some credit, because obviously I've known you for ages, and I've always thought you should have it. I wanted to send you a tweet, but you're not on Twitter. But I tweeted a picture of you and me at the Concert Angels reunion gig, saying the only other Concert Angels fan in the world is now Poet Laureate. Do you still? Because you and I had a kind of standoff at one point. You wrote a book about your love of music and being in bands called Gig, which I shamelessly ripped off from my current book, How Does It Feel? Thanks very much.
Yeah, how? In what way is that a standoff?
No, that wasn't the standoff. The standoff was about... No, I just ripped you off. The standoff was about which one of us was the biggest Concert Angels
fan. No, I think you definitely take that accolade. You own some of their equipment, don't
you? I do.
Yeah.
And I bought it, I didn't steal it. So, do you still love the Concerts like you always did?
I absolutely do, yeah. I'm still unembarrassed about my love of music. I'm of that generation which will talk openly about how much, you know, the relevance and the importance of music in my life and how it's meant just as much as literature has done. And I've also gone back to playing vinyl recently, and so, you know, they're an obvious sort of go-to band because I've got all the vinyl. And completely still mesmerized by the whole thing.
Are you still playing with your band that you reformed whilst writing Gig? Is it Scaremongers?
The Scaremongers, yeah. We're very...
Got a laugh. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I know. Must have come to one of the gigs. We played here, actually. We played here in a venue in the woods that I've never seen since.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
it was like the, how did you go down?
The Bracken Arena or something. How did we go down? We were legendary. Interesting word, that, isn't it? So, we're very underground. We're very underground. you're really to be in the know to appreciate what's going on fully with the band. And that includes band members.
And... because this is theoretically a film podcast, and I know that when you, because you and I used to do the Mark Radcliffe show together, Mark and Larcher, the Graveyard Shift, as it was known, out of Manchester, and I was there talking about films, and you were there doing poetry, but we did talk about films. Somebody said, are you still enthusiastic about cinema? Do you still go to the pictures?
I do, yeah. I mean, I think, like probably a lot of people, I've got quite lazy. You know, TVs have got bigger, and they sit there in the corner of the room, and it's, you know, it's probably easier just to click a button than it is to get in the car to go down to the Odeon. But I've seen one or two films.
What have you seen recently? I can see you struggling to think of a film that you've seen recently in the cinema. What was the last thing you saw in a cinema?
Okay, that's a good question. So the last film, I'm not going to be able to remember the title.
Okay,
but it's about two young lads in Scotland at the height of the rave culture.
Beats.
That's right. Yeah. Saw that in Leeds about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
And what did you think?
I was slightly disappointed with the film, but there was.
But you thought the cinema was nice, and the toilet facilities were tip top.
Actually, there was an incredible rave scene in the middle of the film, and that was astonishing. And I don't think I've ever seen 10 minutes in a film which more accurately represented that era and that lifestyle and that sensation. So for that reason alone, it was worth going to see.
Has anyone here seen Beats? Okay, well, it's
a recherché choice.
No, it's really... I've never understood what that means. What does recherché actually mean?
It means of choice, doesn't it? Well-researched.
I don't know. I literally don't know. I used it in a sentence once, and somebody looked at me quizzically because I thought it meant something else. So it means of choice.
What is this, Dictionary Corner?
No, it's just... You're the poet laureate, Simon. Who else am I going to ask?
I know.
That's literally your job.
It is not literally my job. It shades into definition on occasion. I would give you that.
Okay, well, if you haven't seen Beats, I think it is well worth seeing. There is this sequence in the middle of... The whole film is in black and white, but there is this sequence in the middle of it in which they're in a sort of trance rave situation. And I have never been in a trance rave situation or any of the things that go with it. And the film turns into... And it almost turns into like a scene from Altered States, the Ken Russell film. And I did think for the first time, oh, I understand what being out of your head dancing to trance music must be like as a result of that bit of the film, which I thought was brilliant.
Yeah, no, completely. It was a very sort of transcendent moment in the film, and you know, the colours are all turned up. It becomes very, it becomes a kind of sort of fantasia in the middle of the film.
What's your favourite film of all time?
My favourite film of all time is... I don't know.
What have you seen more than... What do you go back to? You're at home.
Okay, okay.
You don't have to take a phone call from Theresa May because she's doing other stuff.
Yep.
What would you put on?
You know what? I would probably watch any of the This doesn't sound like a very laureate choice, but I would probably watch any of the Bourne films, the first three Bourne films. Yeah, and it's not just because of the sort of stylized action sequence and so on and so forth. There's something particularly about the first film, which is very upsetting, and it's to do with identity.
Yeah,
he doesn't know who he is, and that's an incredibly powerful motif in a film. It even starts with him floating, almost dead, in the sea, in this sort of amniotic fluid. His name is Bourne, and he's dragged out of the sea, and he's given this strange...
And the film is called The Bourne Identity.
Yeah, and this sort of strange reverse birth in the opening scene where they take out of his, I think out of his arm, some kind of magnetic tag. I don't know if the original, or is it Robert Ludlum who wrote the
yeah, and then the films, the sequels are directed by Paul Greengrass, but the first one is directed by Doug Liman. Thank you.
Well, I've never got tired of watching those. Oh, and also anything by Richard Curtis.
We are going to be doing top five Richard Curtis films later on in the podcast, just to be clear. And do you think that the movies that you're watching now are few and far between as they are? Are you part of this, the golden age of cinema? I think we're living through a golden age now. I think we're living through a better age of animation than we've ever been in before. I think there are more and more diverse films. And people say, it's all superhero movies. No, it isn't. It's maybe all superhero movies at the local multiplex, but I think we're in a real golden period. You can see more international cinema now than ever before. You can watch it at home, you can watch it in the cinema, the opportunities are endless.
I wonder if that's something that is almost true of every art form at the moment. I hear people talking about music in those terms. I hear people talking about TV drama in those terms as well.
Do you watch a lot of TV drama?
I do, and actually when you were asking me about my favourite film, I mean it's not a film, but I probably would want to go on to talk about Big Little Lies,
yeah.
Which I honestly think the first series, anyway, I haven't finished watching the second series, is, in my view, one of the greatest things ever made for the small screen. Incredibly powerful, moving, upsetting, fantastic female characters, all centred around squabbles at the school gates that are then impacting back into people's lives, into these kind of rich, powerful lives of Monterey housewives and their husbands. So yeah, absolutely astonishing.
And you've made a program with many programs for television. I remember I read, and it may even have been in Gig, that you made something that then I was reviewing on television, and you said you were so scared you ended up watching it from behind the sofa.
Yeah, it was a TV. I mean, I made lots of TV documentaries with some kind of written poetic component, or I've written song lyrics for them. And this was a film in that genre, and it was called Pornography the Musical, where we'd attempted to make an earnest documentary about the lives and experience of women in the sex industry. And I think you quite rightly pointed out on, it was Late Review or something like that, that... It wasn't a huge success. I was actually referring in the book to the fact that it was TV you needed to watch from behind the settee.
Right.
It was advertised by, I think it was Channel 4, as the most sexually graphic film ever to be shown on national network TV. So not a huge success, but fantastic viewing figures.
But also, you'd had a huge success before that with Felton Sings, and you have had very, very good experiences with television.
Felton Sings was just an amazing opportunity. We went into Felton Young Offenders Institute near Heathrow, and I wrote song lyrics for people serving time in the prison. And one of the astonishing things about that environment is that the prison campus, if you like, is just full of peacocks. There are peacocks wandering around, sitting on top of the various cell blocks and so on and so forth. And all the blocks are named after birds. There were obvious kind of writing opportunities. And the film did really well. It won a BAFTA, won an Ivor Novello Award for the songwriting. And we really want to go back in there now. I can't remember, I think it might have been 2002. really want to go back in, because I mean, crime has changed, youth culture has changed, the prisons have changed, but also I want to try and I would really like the opportunity of following up on the lives of some of those lads who were in the prison at that time, who'll be, you know, in their 30s and 40s.
Is the fact that you're Poet Laureate going to make doing that any easier? Do you now have clout that you wouldn't have before? I mean, apart from the fact that it impresses the shit out of me, does it impress everybody else?
Well, one of the things about the laureateship is that it is a royal appointment, and however you feel about that, it gets you into rooms with people and enables conversations that were difficult to generate previously. So we're fishing around at Feltham, and hopefully something might come up.
Do you feel like you have a kind of superpower now? It does feel like with great power comes great responsibility, but I love the idea that you have a superpower, that you can now get into rooms with people and do things and change the world.
Without opening the door. So that kind of superpower. No, I still do the washing up.
Do you wake up in the morning and think, I'm Poet Laureate? Oh, come on, you must do.
So, other favourite films?
Is there a title? Do you have your lordship, your highness, your regalness, O Queen? Is there?
No, not that I know of. No, I'm still just Sir Simon to you, Mark.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to ask you one last thing, and then we're going to bring in our next guest. And I want you to stay, if that's all right, unless you have some door to walk through magically. Has anybody at all in your... Because one of the things about you is you've always been brilliantly down to earth, and you're very good at kind of knocking down any pretensions. Has anybody that you know or in your family or anything said to you, yeah, Poet Laureate?
I'll tell you a nicer story than that, actually, because I suppose when you embark on any kind of career or adventure of any kind, I think there's something in the back of your mind says that at some point in your life you want to go back to your parents and say, this worked out.
Yeah.
And I used to be a probation officer in Manchester, and probably that was the point that was furthest away from the laureateship than ever.
Yeah.
And when I gave that job up, my dad, who was also a probation officer,
yeah,
I think was, you know, quite rightly fairly nervous, because I was leaving a profession with a pension and security and all that kind of stuff at a time when there weren't many jobs, to go and do poetry, which had no guarantees with it whatsoever. So it was just a really moving thing to go back to my mum and dad and say, this is kind of worked out, really. And he said to me, because my granddad used to write a little bit, and my dad said to me, if your granddad had been alive today, this would have killed him.
There's a moment that you write about in one of your books in which you're going through a secondhand bookstore, and you find... Do you want to tell this story better than... You could probably tell it better than me, so go ahead.
Well, it's a slightly elaborated story, a kind of amalgamation of five or six different episodes, but it was about the kind of most embarrassing experience of being a poet, and it was after a reading that hadn't gone very well, waking up in a strange town one morning, trying to find the train station, and walking through a precinct and seeing a dump bin outside a bookshop, which was full of books for 10 pence, and having a look in there and finding a copy of one of my own books, which was a signed copy, and underneath the signature it said, "To Mum and Dad."
But it's not true, right? You embellished the Mum and Dad.
It's an amalgamation.
It's an amalgamation of the truth.
Of experiences felt and experienced.
Okay. I am so pleased about the laureate. I can't tell you how impressed I am.
Thank you very much.
Nobody deserves it more than you. It's brilliant. Thank you. He's going to stay, but ladies and gentlemen, please round of applause for Simon Armitage. As As I said before, all this is going to go out on the Kermode on Film podcast, which we were really thrilled the other day because we passed 1 million downloads. My next guest has a podcast which has 70 million and it's astonishing numbers. One of the most successful podcasts around, from The Guilty Feminist. Please welcome Deborah Francis White. It's a bit of an awkward step, isn't it?
I wasn't sure. I wanted to do it in a game. I'm a feminist, but I wanted that to be elegant. It wasn't.
It was more elegant than me and Simon attempting to do it. Welcome to the show. Firstly, congratulations on the extraordinary success of the Guilty Feminist podcast. How long has it been going? And how has it become so huge, other than the fact that it's brilliant and funny and very listenable?
It's become so huge because women are thirsty. That's all it is. Like, when we started at 3.5 years ago, we had 30 people in the audience, 20 of whom I knew by name, and 10 of their mates. And we just played the Royal Albert Hall. And it's because there's not a lot of content that is made by women, directed towards women, that's allowed to come through the regular channels. Okay. If I'd gone to a television network or a radio station 3.5 years ago and said, I want to do a show with feminist in the title, they would have said no. Because they just would have thought that wouldn't have sold. Yeah. And I'm constantly fascinated now by how many films and TV shows I watch where the point of view is consistently male and almost exclusively Caucasian, and you just keep on looking through the same eyes. And I was thinking, I watched It's a Wonderful Life at Christmas, 2 Christmases ago, with Susan McComa, who does the podcast a lot, who's an amazing, fabulous actress, who's a phenomenal black woman. And she was sitting there crying as Jimmy Stewart was thinking, oh, what if I'd never been born? And I thought, when does a white man ever look through a black woman's eyes at Christmas and cry? Never. It's never happened. If a white man watches a movie about a black woman at Christmas, it's because he's watching something foreign or niche. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and I've watched a film about black women. But it's just normal for people who aren't white men to just... We're just used to it. We're used to sort of getting into their bodies and making them the hero. And I think we've just built up so much empathy over time for white men for that reason. We've all built up a lot of empathy. And so I feel like it's time. It's time to start saying there are other eyes you can look out of. And I think that's what the success of The Guilty Feminist is.
For anyone who doesn't know, can you explain what Guilty Feminist, what you mean by that, why the podcast is called that?
Yes, it's The Guilty Feminist is, it's basically, the idea is, I wanted to be better at feminism. I wanted to take up more space in the world. I wanted to make the world a fairer place. But I kept thinking, I don't think I'm good enough. And I was talking to a comedian that I started the podcast with, who's gone on to do other things now, but called Sophie Hagen. And I was saying, I just think I'm not good enough. Like, I just don't think... When I see these other feminists on stage, I think, yeah, they're so strident and they know what they're doing, and I don't. And so we started the podcast with this cold open, which is I'm a Feminist But. So where we admit our paradoxes and insecurities. So one of the first ones I did was, I'm a Feminist But. One time I went on a women's rights march and I popped into a department store to use the loo and I got distracted trying out face cream. And when I came out, the march was gone. And I thought, oh my God, they're going to kick me out of the club. But of course, so many women went, I have also done that. Or I've deliberately left a march because it was too crowded and I've ended up having a gin and tonic in a pub. You know, it's so when we confess those things, you know, some of them are film-based. I'm a Feminist But. I secretly love very problematic film, Pretty Woman. And in truth, I'm open to the idea of Richard Gere paying £3,000 to enter me on a grand piano. True story. True story. I'm a feminist, but I secretly have fantasies about being sexually dominated by famous fictitious misogynist Don Draper from Mad Men, and truly believe if I met him, I could make him whole and heal his pain.
I'm with you on Richard Gere, because I love Richard Gere. I just love Richard Gere in anything. I think Richard, the best thing about Richard Gere is this. Richard Gere's entire acting, and I have no problem with this, is based on a single gesture, which is that he blinks, and then he closes his eyes, looks down to the left, and exhales. So if he's doing something, it's just genius. Watch it. Like, so if it's an emotional moment, he'll do that. And then if somebody says to him, you know, and your mother's dead, he goes, and it's it's like a whole career.
Wow.
And the thing is, it works for anything. He can be like a corrupt cop, or he can be, you know, like a rock star. Doesn't matter what he's doing. He just and it, but it, it, when he his head and it's always to, and I just. That's genius.
That is Mark Bonner. I just made
that'll
an
go really well on the podcast on the audio, incidentally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. I felt like I should describe it at the time. It's up your blink rate, look down to the left, exhale, look up, and that's the answer to being a very famous popular film star. Mark Bonner taught me. I just made a film. I wrote a film called Say My Name, which is like a screwball comedy. And Mark Bonner. Do you know Mark Bonner? Who's from? He's an amazing actor, Scottish actor. And he's in Catastrophe as the sort of slightly psychotic best friend. And he plays a bad guy in our film. And he taught me the psychopathic stare, which is such a nice man in real life. But he said, you put your head down and then just your eyes up and you penetrate the other person's eyes with your eyes. Which now I think about it, sounds rude. But I'll try it on you.
Okay. Awesome. Do I need to take my glasses off?
No, it's me.
No, I know, but fine.
I can penetrate your eyes you've got your glasses on.
Okay, fine.
If anything, it's protection, okay. Mark. We've only just met.
Okay.
I don't know why I've got the microphone up. But it's not audio. Okay.
Again, this is great radio. To be honest, you just look a bit arch. You look you look like you're going a bit like, ooh, you know.
Have I done the carry-on psychopath?
Yeah, exactly. There was a touch of ooh matron about it. Okay, so now you've made a film, but it's taken. You first got a script optioned in Hollywood years and years ago. So tell us about your Hollywood experience.
So in 2006, I sold a romantic comedy called The Wedding Pact, I'd written with two other friends, Monica and Philippa, and we'd spent 2 years writing it and sort of having these fantasies that we would sell it in Hollywood, and then remarkably did. It was actually in LA, and we went over there, and once you've sold something, everyone else wants to meet you, because everyone's job in Hollywood is not to be fired. And so once somebody, and they have tracking boards so they don't get fired. So once the boss of Fox Searchlight has read your script, the boss of every single other studio will read your script, because if the film's a hit, and then the head of Paramount will say to whoever was meant to be reading those scripts, why didn't I see that script? And the only answers then can be is,
did.
I didn't, yeah, exactly, that's the only right answer. The other answers are, I didn't read it, in which case you don't know the right agents, or I read it and passed on it, in which case you can't spot a script. The only right answer is, you read it, I gave it to you, you passed on it. And that's the only thing that will stop you getting fired. So once you've sold a script, then everyone wants to meet you. Everyone's got to meet you. And at the beginning of the week, we had 15 meetings. At the end, we had 35. Because they said we were three women, and they then especially were only used to meeting like one geeky guy in a baseball cap or two geeky guys in baseball caps. And we were three women, and we were all improvisers and actors. And so they said we gave good meeting. That's what got around. Those girls give good meeting. And so we were rocking up in all these places having these funny experiences. And mostly it was women, 35-year-old women, who thought we could solve their relationship problems because we'd written a romantic comedy. And we're suddenly like, I mean, he's in New York, I'm in LA, but he can move, I can't move. And we were like, what do you think? Because he really reminds me of Max in your script. And that was basically the meetings. And then we were pitching stuff, coming up with ideas in the car park to pitch. And then finally we got a meeting with what was said to be the most indie sort of art house production house in all of Hollywood.
Yeah.
As far as I could make out, they just remade Love in the Times of Cholera over and over. They were just people who adapted novels. So we didn't know where they wanted to meet us. And we went in and we pitched the most indie sort of cheap thing we could think of, which basically wasn't a very good idea. It's basically like the plot of a sitcom. It's basically like a plot of an episode of Frasier, which is two couples, the man, two heterosexual couples, the man of this couple and the woman of this couple end up New Year's Eve snowed into a hut in upstate, in a cabin in upstate New York, don't know each other. The other couple had a fling in college. This couple don't know, and they get snowed into O'Hare Airport. and you track what these two couples are doing. So we pitch this, and this guy goes, I think my boss would really like this. Do you mind if we take you in? So we go into this office, and there's a guy, basically, you know the orange guy? Don't let a mobile phone ruin your movie. That guy, the producer, would have had a big cigar if you could have smoked inside in Hollywood. And he looked at us, and this young guy went, oh, these girls have just sold a script to Searchlight. And he looked at us and went, huh, sold a script to Searchlight, have you? Who's your agent? And we went, oh, we don't really have an agent, we have a manager. And he went, that's bullshit. You're writers. You don't need a manager. You need an agent. How much is this manager taking from you? We went, I don't know, 15%. He said, that's bullshit. You get yourself an agent, you tell him you're going to give him 5%, then you tell him to go fuck himself. And there was another guy in the room who he'd been having a meeting with, and he went, this is Andy. He works for ICA. He's your new agent. He's your new agent. He just kicked shit out of me on this table. We went 5 rounds on this table. He kicked shit out of me. He'll get you the best deal. And then Andy goes, but you kicked shit out of me too. We kicked shit out of each other. We kicked shit out of each other. They basically got their penises out and measured them. And we were just standing there going, oh my God. So I just went, okay, Andy. Well, apparently you're our new agent. We'd like you to take 5% and go fuck yourself. And this guy, Drew, he went, so you're funny. Sit down and tell me about this idea. How long's your pitch? And we went, oh, 5 minutes. And he went, make it 3. I'm not making any of this up. I am aware it sounds like I am. So we tell him the story, you know, snowed in log cabin, snowed in O'Hare Airport. And he went, could it be on the beach in Brazil? I got a lot of money down there. Beautiful weather. And we went, no, not really, no, because the only thing we've got is snow. And he went, I got a lot of money in Brazil. It's beautiful down there. You tell me a love story set on the beach in Brazil. I won't just develop that movie. I'll make that movie. And we went, so they're on the beach in Brazil. And the others are snowed in our hair, but we don't really see them. It's focused on the ones on the beautiful beach in Brazil. And he went, and he said, and what are they talking about? And I said, they're talking about monogamy, actually, because they're the wrong couple. And the nature of flirtation and monogamy. He went, monogamy? I can't sell monogamy. Sex is what I can sell. You tell me a sexual awakening story set on the beach in Brazil, I will just develop that movie, I'll make that movie. And we went, so he's having a sexual awakening. And we went, look, this isn't the thing for you, but we will go away and come up with something. And we did, and we pitched it. We were back in London, so we pitched it over the phone. And he heard it over the phone, and he went, This is too graphic for this tent now, what he said. So I'll just cut to the bit where he said, do you have a lawyer? And we went, yeah. He said, good, because I eat lawyers for breakfast. And cliches too, apparently. And said, I'm going to make this movie. You girls did a great job. Change the ending, but you girls did a great job. And then we heard nothing. He kept putting it off and putting it off. And our manager was going, this is not right. They shouldn't say you've got a deal unless you've got a deal. They blow smoke up your ass, but they shouldn't say a deal unless you've got a deal. Anyway, there was the sort of the big independent film crash and everything. And then we read in the trades, while waiting for our deal, because he kept saying throughout the whole thing, I want women to write this movie. I want women to write a sexual awakening movie.
Set on the beach.
I want women to write it. Do you know why I want women to write it? I don't want men to write it. Do you know what men will write? Porn. I don't want porn. I want magical realism, like where the wind blows things in and shit. Like with Judi Dench, like Chocola. You know what I mean? When the wind blows things in and shit? And we were like, yeah, we know what you mean. Beautiful, not porn. And we were like, okay, we can write that. So when this went on for ages and ages, and then we didn't hear anything, and the manager was chasing, we didn't hear anything, and he was fobbing him off. And then we read in the trades, we read in Variety, that this same guy had just optioned The Anatomist, which is a book about the man who discovered the clitoris. Good times. And he had, the quote was, it's going to be magical realism like Chocolat, and we all just went, not porn! And that was the end of our movie. And that is everything you need to know about Hollywood in one story.
It's extraordinary for me listening to that, because if I closed my eyes, you could have been talking about the world of poetry. Lawyers, agents, Hollywood, sending that new sonnet to Spielberg.
Do you have an agent? So is it, how does it work in... I mean, poetry must be... It's much more, you know...
It's not a frontline art form in the way that in the way that others are. I think, but by its own choice, really. You know, it's an art form of dissent. So I think whatever else is making the run in the world, poetry tends to sort of cower away from that. Having said that, you know, there's an incredibly energized spoken word scene at the moment, and performance poetry scene, which has really been generated at festivals like this.
Have you ever been asked to write a film?
I was on that circuit for a while. I wrote a novel called Little Green Man and kept writing and rewriting and doing further drafts of a screenplay for it. And I have to say, it was incredibly lucrative. But I just found it creatively not very satisfying. I was just sort of going round and round in circles. And I think what I just hadn't... Somebody just needed to say to me, look, it's a film. One problem, one solution. I was trying to get all the intricacies of each paragraph of the novel into the script, and that just wasn't working.
When I was watching you and I was off stage, I was sitting next to a Syrian man who's incredibly articulate. His English, he's got the kind of English where he knows the difference between infer and imply. And he's very erudite. But he just leaned over to me, because he's only been in the country 2 years, and he went, "What's a laureate? Is it some kind of wine taster?" I said, "Apparently, yes."
Turns out.
Now, Simon, you said earlier on when I asked you about your favourite films, you said, you talked about Bourne, but you said obviously anything by Richard Curtis. And I know W would be a huge Richard Curtis fan as well, because frankly, who isn't?
I genuinely am, and that's made it sound like you're not. I really am. My favourite film in the world is The Apartment, and I love with all my heart, really, really love The Tall Guy and Four Weddings and a Funeral. And I got to be a featured extra, as I'm telling my friends. Who spotted me in the Four Weddings comic relief, Where Are They Now? Yeah. It was like a fantasy come true for me.
A featured extra means that you have a line.
No, you just loll around. Right, and you're somebody that they hope people will go, her at the wedding guest. Okay. No, I've bigged my part up there. I should have said I was an extra. Okay. But what Emma said to me, Richard's wife, probably to flatter me, you're a featured extra, which means I was going to talk to Andy McDowell, who gave me some fucking great advice, by the way. She was incredible, because I was just about to do this photo shoot. I'd never done a front cover of a magazine before, so I was asking posing advice from her and Lily James. And so the three of us were talking. Lily said, I find with posing for photo shoots, the best thing is to look a little tired or a little bit grumpy and just sort of do that, and then you get these really sultry pictures. And Andy said, "Oh no, that's for women under 30. Don't give her that advice." She was like, "When you're over 30, it's lift, lift, lift." She was like, "Yes, you can loll when you're 29. 31, lift." Really good advice. And it was really genuinely sisterly advice. It was, and I really did lift, and it worked.
All of which is a very strange way of getting round to our next guest, which is Richard Curtis. Yeah, otherwise it would be all too cramped. Richard, welcome to the show. Lovely to have you back. Yesterday was shown at Latitude. Yesterday.
Yes.
And of course...
I was disappointed Simon wasn't in the audience. I'm sceptical of his enthusiasm for my oeuvre.
You have him here.
But was it because he'd already seen it, do you think? Or do you think he was writing a poem?
I don't know. Shall we shamelessly quiz him?
No, let's not. It'll just go badly. So, don't ask me about his poems either. So, I know there's a great one about Batman.
Yes. So yesterday played at Latitude yesterday, yeah. And there are scenes in yesterday that are shot at Latitude. Were they shot here last year, or did you recreate Latitude for the purpose of the?
No. We shot here last year. Yeah, we were wandering around. It was a lovely day. We got lots of great people, and we actually shot more than we than we used. Tragically, there was meant to be a section where the hero was going around looking at other bands and seeing he was worse than them. And one of the bands we shot was my son's band, but he got cut even before the assembly of the
movie.
Wow,
you cut your own son out of a film?
Yeah, yeah, he wasn't a featured extra.
I mean, featured extra. Hashtag featured extra.
I think that basically means taller than the other extras. That's basically a featured extra is over 5 foot six.
I was in a very long red coat that stood out. I wanted to wear my fascinator that says feminist in feathers, yeah. But unfortunately it was in the wrong part of London. As is often happens, it was with my Milner. I'm accessible.
Can I just say, if we're playing this game of one-upmanship, I had a speaking part in Absolutely Fabulous. Thank you very much.
I remember that. I actually remember that.
I delivered a line.
What was the line?
Would you like to hear the line?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
It was marvellous. I was very good. And I didn't get the joke until afterwards when I saw it back. It was I was meant to be very entranced by some cabaret singer who couldn't actually sing. And somebody said, have you seen her before? And I said, I don't believe I said this without getting the joke. I said, I've always been a fan of her boosh. And then it was only when I watched it on television, it's a pun, I didn't get it. And then it got a big laugh, but I was more of it because I hadn't realised that it was a rude joke.
Because boosh means end.
B-O-U-C-H-E.
Yeah, like boosh. Rear.
I don't know what it means.
Let's ask Simon, he'll know what it means.
It's a French word.
In French, it means...
What does bouche mean?
End, doesn't it?
Mouth.
Mouth.
Mouth, la bouche. Right. Fermez la bouche. Yeah, it's... Amuse-bouche, yes.
Amuse-bouche.
Oh, yes, it does. Sorry.
It doesn't mean it amuses your end. It means it amuses your mouth. Anyway,
oh, yes.
It's quite weird. Both words we've asked Simon about are French. Because recherche is French, isn't it?
I still don't know what
recherche
means.
I don't think he
means.
Should be expected to know both English and French. I think English is enough.
He recently did a brilliant translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which I know is not technically another... I mean, it's translation is one of the things that he got the laureate for. It does feel like we're picking on him, so I think we should...
You can call me by my name.
No, do you know, I increasingly love poetry. I'm reading more and more of it. I have a kind of... it's nice to know when you've got shallow feelings what might be underneath, you know, and actually the poets serve that purpose. They take things, you have a tiny instinct is happening to you, and then reveal... as it were, what might be the cause of it. I'm finding it... Although, oddly, I don't like poems I don't agree with. Do you know what I mean? If they go off and say everything in the world is horrid, I slightly lose interest, whereas if they say there's hope. But I find poetry more and more necessary. And on the feminism front, I notice an enormous amount of quoting of poetry and back reference. And didn't... The squad just quoted that poem by Maya Angelou, didn't they, as an answer?
Yeah.
As an answer to Trump, actually, as it were, spiritual evidence of that which is right and wrong. Mm. I think it was called I Will Rise, is
and
that right?
And Still I Rise.
Yeah, and Still I Rise.
We just had that, we just played the Royal Albert Hall, and the second act, we opened with a speech that Emmeline Pankhurst had given at the Royal Albert Hall in 1908. She'd been released from prison unexpectedly and said, take me to the Royal Albert Hall, where the WSPU were having a rally. And there was a chair on stage, sort of, it was meant to be metaphorical because they knew Emmeline was in prison. When she walked out, the crowd went wild. And she gave this speech, which presumably she was knocking up in prison in case she got released. And it started, the excerpt we used, it was Juliet Stevenson, just a spotlight came on her, and it started with, they say that women have no sense of humour. Which, of course, is just... we've been saying the same things for so long, you realise. And then it went up to... the spot went up to the choir, and Susan McComa was there, and she did And Still I Rise. And we continued on with 15 women all doing readings. And I was surprised by how much poetry we used, because it demonstrated how women through the ages of different races and different sexual orientations have been saying the same thing for so long. And I'm interested in using more poetry now, so, I feel.
So, Simon, is poetry on the rise in that case? So is it more relevant than ever?
I think it's more prevalent in people's lives. And I think there's a lot of overtly political poetry around now, probably in response to our current circumstances. I was just thinking actually of those great moments in film where poetry is sort of coalesced. It's brought about a particular moment. I mean, of course, in Four Weddings and a Funeral, the Auden poem Funeral Blues has become one of the great film moments, and people often talk about that as I think that's actually a moment that's turned people on, tuned people in to poetry. And I was thinking about that. Is there a film? Is it Rumblefish? The film Rumblefish.
Yeah, Rumblefish. Yeah.
And I remember hearing sort of snippets of poetry and that, just as it sort of moved away from dialogue. And in Terrence Malick's Thin Red Line, some of those inner thoughts that just come drifting through as lines of internal monologue poetry, incredibly, incredibly strong.
Yeah. Mm.
I particularly enjoyed in the comic relief Four Weddings and a Funeral sequel, in which I was a featured extra, that the Alden was replaced by Ed Sheeran.
Yeah, another great contemporary poet.
Look, I want to talk a little bit about Yesterday. Can we just, from a promotional point of view, because I really like, can we just show the trailer of Yesterday? Would you mind if we do that?
Well, Simon's already seen the film, so he won't he won't be very. Well, no, but yeah, this might tempt you, Simon.
Just to go, okay, watch it.
Out of home.
Here we go.
Until a month ago, you were a complete failure. And then somehow you became the biggest star in the world. As if by magic. So what happened?
Jeez. Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
John, Paul, George and Ringo, the Beatles. No. Stop it. Yesterday. It's one of the greatest songs ever written.
Well, it's not Coldplay. It's not Fix You.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I have to tell you, I mean, you know anyway, but I loved it. I sat there in the screening room and I was on my own. There wasn't anybody else there. I had like a private screening because I'd missed the National Press show. And I started crying. One of the things I love doing in the cinema more than anything is crying. And no, I love it. It's because cinema is a machine for empathy, and crying is an empathetic experience. And I laughed and cried my way through the movie. I absolutely loved it. Obviously, it's directed.
Well, thank you very much indeed.
But obviously, it's directed by Danny Boyle. But it is very much. I can't say Danny Boyle without doing that. It is very much a film to Richard Curtis, isn't it?
Well, it's like better directed than the last three. I was very disappointed by my last director's work. But Danny's made films in lots of genres.
Yeah.
You know, as it were, he has done sci-fi, social realism, you know, all the things that he's done.
Yeah.
Man with arm trapped in rock genre.
It's a small genre.
Very small genre. And so I would hope, as it were, that he would reflect the romance and the comedy of it. But I just think he's done it really well with a good sort of different energy and visual imagination and all those things he does so wonderfully.
How did you go about getting the clearances to the songs? Because you've got, there's loads of Beatles songs in it. Yeah. Presumably you had to get individually the remaining Beatles to sign off on it.
I think the Beatles have a, you know, wonderfully constructed system around them, and I think if it had been a movie about a serial killer who loves Beatles music, they would have said no. So they reached a sort of general judgment that it looked like it would be okay and that the plot was okay. And since all the songs are covers until the very final moment, as it were, they didn't have to commit the actual Beatles originals to it. So on balance. But they gave us this amazing deal where we could have any 17 songs. We could pick any of them for a sort of lump price.
And every single one of them, he said up until the very end, that is performed by Himesh Patel. He's performing live. That's him playing and singing.
Always him playing and singing, because it would have been dreadful to dub. In fact, one of the scenes I'm most uncomfortable with in the movie, if anyone sees it, see if you can spot it. There's a scene just over there next to the film tent and the comedian tent where there was a very, very noisy comedian going on. So it's like one of the key scenes of the movie, and we had to dub that over in post, and I can tell.
So you know,
it's like Himesh's voice has dropped since when we shot it.
The idea came from an idea that you and somebody else had some time ago. What was the germ of the idea?
No. What happens, I actually got a phone call from my friend Nick Angel to say that he had a film by this guy Jack Barth with this idea. And I said, look, I'm nervous about adapting things, but as it were, if you want me to write a film about that idea, I'd love to, because I'm obsessive Beatles fan. I'd love to have a conversation with Simon sometime about where he thinks pop music fits in poetry, because as it were, you know, Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature, didn't he?
And he was so gracious about it. Lovely speech he gave.
The more I listen to the Beatles music, the more I'm impressed actually by the lyrics. There's a line I'm really haunted by in She's Leaving Home, that line where he says they read the note that she hoped would say more. It's so tragic that neither of them get what they wanted out of the words that she leaves them with. So I've just been an obsessive Beatles fan from 7 till 63. So the idea of writing, spending 2 whole years in their company was, you know, utter joy.
But will you still need them when you're 64?
Oh, do you know what? I have started looking into hotels on the Isle of Wight. I've actually started researching, and I think we're going to go there. I'm trying to find 3 friends called Vera, Chuck, and Dave who we can take with us.
Okay,
can't find a Vera.
So Simon, are you a Beatles fan?
Yeah, Beatles fan. Yeah, they're pretty good. I've enjoyed their music. I was thinking about what you were saying, Richard. I mean, I have very sort of strong views about poetry and song lyrics, that they are two very different art forms. That, you know, in the Venn diagram of the two things, there is a cross-hatched area in the middle, but they're both very exacting art forms. And I think one of the interesting things about song lyrics is that if you take them away and you give them to people who don't know the tunes, and I've done this with my students, you know, these are sort of youngish kids who've never really heard Dylan or the Beatles, and you present them to them, they don't think much of them. They're kind of like poems, but they do everything that we tell them not to do in a poem, you know, cheesy rhymes, hypermetric syllables, mixed metaphors, all that kind of thing. The thing that is astonishing about a song lyric is the way it works with this stuff that we don't really understand called music. And the music quite often supplies the emotional content. So in a song, you can write la 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 la, and if you put that in combination with the right chord change, it can be absolutely transformative. If you put la 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 in a poem, probably not going to work that well, really. But it, you know, the emotional content of a song is more than usually provided by something to do with an instrument or the tone of voice.
But I think they can be remarkable too. I remember people always saying to me, what poem would you read at a wedding? And I seem to remember there was a poetry book called For Weddings and Funerals. And I still think that the lyrics of Let It Be Me by the Everly Brothers are the best poem, even without the words. And I remember when my sister died, at her funeral, my brother read a song by the Waterboys called Everlasting Arms. And that was the best thing that we could find. So I think it's that we're within that format are many great things, even though it's where they don't work as poems, but it's just the most mystical use of language. Yeah,
yeah. Do you have a favourite Beatles line or a favourite Beatles couplet?
Aren't these all the kind of questions that you should have asked me to think about yesterday?
Well, if I thought about them yesterday, Simon, but the
seems your troubles were so far away.
Yeah, exactly.
Come back to me.
Okay. Deborah?
I think Picture Yourself in a Boat on a River is just
stunning. Oh yeah, that's mine too.
It's actually a description of latitude, isn't it, really?
Yes, absolutely.
Go on, Richard, favourite Beatles couplet or line?
Oh, I have no idea. Bright are the stars that shine, dark is the sky.
Oh, that's
I know this love of mine will never die, and I love her.
Very good.
Blackbird, the lyrics of Blackbird. Himesh actually was here this weekend and he played it on the guitar, and it just, there's just something about that. Every word of Blackbird is just, will break your heart. I think it's one of the greatest songs ever written.
My friend Matt O'Casey, who I played with yesterday on the stage, I've been a friend of him for ages, and we've been in bands together, and if him playing Blackbird will absolutely reduce everybody to tears. It's such a beautiful song, he plays it so brilliantly. I still think the best Beatles, and I always get it wrong. I came to the Beatles late because my wife Linda is a huge Beatles fan, and it was one of those things that, you know, I brought The Who and she brought Led Zeppelin and the Beatles, and it took me a long time to get into it. And in the end, it's either the love you make is equal to the love you take, or the love you take is equal to the love you make. I always get it wrong, but it is still my favourite couplet because it's the end of that.
It's the final lyric they ever wrote too.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there we go.
The last is it?
Even better choice.
Yeah. What? How do you know that?
It just is. It's the last thing on the last album. Like, the last line that Oscar Hammerstein ever wrote was, love, a bell's not a bell till you ring it. A song's not a song till you sing it. And love in your heart wasn't put there to stay. Love's only love when you give it away. And that was the last thing that he ever wrote.
Oh, Richard.
Yeah.
This is magnificent.
And this is the man who wrote, you know, this, what do we do about a problem like Maria? So there were very high standards.
The thing that's really
weird. By the way, we seem to be entering a golden age of musicals. I was just reading an article about it. It's very interesting. What with, you know, The Lion King and La La Land and Rocket Man and everything like that. And I think it's going to lead to original musicals. Danny Boyle, who I've just done this with, says that Danny Boyle says it's like this was his launching pad, and he hopes someone's going to ask him to do a new musical. Because I do think, I remember being on holiday in Cromer, and we'd been promised glamping. But glamping's just camping when it rains.
Yeah.
And we woke up at 10 and we thought, we've got 14 hours. What are we going to do? And Mamma Mia was on, the first one, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was like the happiest 2 hours almost of my life, let alone of my day. But I'm really excited about that because they were so huge when I was young, musicals in cinema, and I think it's
I genuinely think musicals are, and I think the thing that's wonderful about Rocket Man, I know it's an existing song catalogue, but I think what Lee Hall does so brilliantly is it is a musical. It's not a film with songs in it. It is actually constructed beginning to end as a musical. And I did a program a while ago about Oscar winning films, and musicals are historically one of the most reliable winners of best films. So throughout cinema has been used for musicals. So will you be writing musicals now?
I don't know about that. I want to move on to the subject of women in film.
Oh,
since we've got Deborah, because I think there's a really interesting thing happening here, that there are like lots of really amazing young actresses and not lots of amazing young actors at the moment. I don't know quite what's happened, but if you think of who you think are most brilliant now, as it were, you know, from Saoirse to Chloe Moretz to all the girls who are really extraordinary, to Brie Larson to Jennifer Lawrence, you can't name the young generation of young men who are as interesting. And I think a really weird thing's happening, that in the movies, women can be interesting and men are meant to be the sort of boring leads. We've got into an era of male stereotypes, whereas with men just have to be handsome and have nice bodies, and they're not being encouraged. And I think we're in an era again, I think with musicals, basically, if you look at the best young men nominations, they're all dull and astronauts and things like that, and the
all
women
dull and astronauts,
yeah, well, by yeah. by definition
like going to the moon, you know.
But anyway, that I'm really excited and interested. I think we're also entering a glorious period of women in film,
but
in particular.
I think that's why I'm interested in screwball comedy. So the film I made, Say My Name, is an old-fashioned screwball comedy, because if you go back to that era, it was all kind of Katharine Hepburn walking around saying, I can run a newspaper as well as you or any man, and I can kiss as well as you or any man, but kiss me, but don't, but do. And the man was trying to catch up to the woman all the time. Those women, they were always more interesting characters. So that, for me, is, I think, where I'm stealth going to bring that back. So Say My Name is, he's definitely trying to keep up with her, and she's the interesting one.
But the key thing with some is during the most successful period of cinema, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, the movies that sold the most were movies that we now refer to as women's pictures. But back then, because women audiences outnumbered male audiences, so that was the backbone of cinema. The whole idea that cinema was created for teenage boys is a very, very, you know, recent one. But another thing which is difficult, again, I credit my wife for this, she's been involved in this project called Calling the Shots, which is doing the actual numbers on how many British women working in the British film industry are directors, producers, writers, and the percentages are tiny. Yeah. Like 16% in any of those categories is enormous. Oh, she's over there going lower, lower. So percentage of women, so 10, 12, it's that kind of figure? Yeah, fine. She's literally working me with her foot from over there. I'm just, you know. So it is still really, really, I mean, the way things will change is that the gender of the people that are making the films will change.
There was a short film festival in Australia, and they kept saying the entries that they got in, you enter and then it gets curated. And they kept saying, we can't get above 10% female directed or written or both films. And so somebody said, why don't we do gender-blind submissions? And do you know what happened when they did gender-blind submissions? In 1 year, it went from 10% to 50%. Because we project, as a tribe, as a society, who we decide is good at things like this. So, and we all do it. Women do it too. If you suddenly were given £500,000 and you had to invest it with somebody, you'd probably want to give it to a white man in a grey suit, because who's good with money? Those people. We all have this idea, and this is why films have such a great responsibility, because they seduce us with who's good at, what does a CEO look like? What does a president look like? What does an astronaut look like? They're constantly seducing us. And women on a film set, I know this from my friends who are directors, there is the same reaction to a woman on a film set that there is to a female pilot. Have you ever been on a plane and had a female pilot and having the voice come on going, hello, I'm Captain Jane Sylvester? What happens every single time? There's little jokes that run around, oh, I hope she can land, and oh, I hope she's not on her period. And she knows that. She knows that. And that's partly because we're more frightened of being in the sky than on the ground. And if anything's different on a plane, you know, if you got on a plane and all the seats were backwards, I'd want to know why. Because all of the planes I've not died on have had the seats facing forward, and all of the planes I've not died on so far have had male pilots, bar one or two. But the pilot knows that. She knows that. She knows that if there's turbulence, she will be blamed. So she's flying with this extra weight of expectation. She knows when she goes into the pilot's lounge,
that some of the pilots are a bit like, and some of them are so keen to show that they're fine with the woman pilot. They're like, hello, Jane, sit down. I read The Guardian. You know, she knows it's not normal. And so she flies with that extra weight of expectation. Same things will happen in the comedy tent. If you walk out, probably not here, but in lots of regional comedy clubs, I have been brought on by a compere, the only woman on the bill, and I've been brought on by the male compere. The next one's a woman one, but don't worry, she's funny. I've seen her. And that's your starter for 10. And you walk on stage and you see people in the front row say to each other with their mouths in front of your face, I don't find women funny. I don't like female comedians. So you have to spend the first 5 minutes of the set or the first 2 hours of the flight getting over that. And that's what happens to women in film, that there's an expectation projected upon you that you're not up to the job.
I think telly's helping hugely at the moment. That's my instinct. I don't know, but I think that what with Fleabag and with Killing Eve that are both written and directed by women, and with Catastrophe and Sharon Horgan and
Chewing Gum,
Big Little Lies and things like that, I really think that TV's going to set the path and that's going to bend very quickly.
Yeah.
Game
God,
face.
Simon, you must be relieved that Carol Ann Duffy came before you. Otherwise, you'd be in really tricky waters, wouldn't you?
Well, it was an important conversation that poetry had to have. You know, the laureateship is one of those traditions and rituals that goes as far back as anybody can remember or research. And when Carol Ann was made laureate, it was absolutely essential for not just for the fact that she's a fantastic poet, but a similar thing's been happening in poetry. I mean, like all endeavours, we're not there yet. But it's been really interesting over the last 10 years to see how publishing and poetry's been changing. I mean, 30 years ago when I started writing, you could look at poetry from the outside and think it was a pretty monocultural activity. Mm. And that's definitely not the case now.
Yeah.
Particularly, people from diverse backgrounds, not as represented to the extent that they would like and that they should be. But the situation's definitely changed. And I think particularly in relation to women writers, I think that probably the most exciting poets around at the moment are women writers. Yeah.
But it's important for men too, for women. It's not just important to minorities that they be represented. It's important to the dominant group. It's important for white people to hear more black and brown voices. It's important for us to realise we're not the only people in the world. And if we keep on hearing the same thing over and over again, we get seduced into thinking that we're where it's at, and that's an alternative experience. It's not alternative to be brown if you're brown. It's your whole life. It's not a minority experience for you. And that we can, I started this podcast, The Guilty Feminist, really to wallow in my own oppression and marginalisation. What I've learnt about more than anything is my own privilege. I have started to understand the white woman experience is, and it is such a privileged one. I can run towards law enforcement anytime I want. If I cry, yesterday I was trying to get to a stage, I'd had one of those festival fiascos where you're wandering around outside and you've got to get to your hut and then someone's meant to meet you in a buggy, etc. It doesn't matter. The point is, I was rushing to a stage and this man said, you've got to go back and stand in that queue and have your bad check. And I just thought, I'm going to miss my show. So I just cried. I mean, I did cry genuinely, but also I knew what would happen. He went, don't worry, go through. Do you think if I was a black woman, that would have happened? Do you think if I was a brown man, that would have happened? Imagine if a Middle Eastern man went, I don't want to have my bag checked. He'd have everything checked. Everything checked. So it's important for all of us to be hearing these voices and seeing these things. And it's not enough. What we're doing now is going, let's have a white man, a white man, a white man, a white man, and a black woman who can be a best friend. If you're not empathising with her, if we don't follow her, when she leaves, it doesn't matter. It's not relevant at all. It's great to have her there. But what matters is we see it through her eyes and we feel it through her skin and we understand what that experience is. And that's where we've got to get with poetry, with film, with television, with novels, with everything. We've got to start looking through other people's eyes. It's so important and it's never going to change unless we do. It's the reason Trump is in power. Because we all empathise with white men. It's the reason Trump got into power. Hollywood is a lot to blame. We've only been empathising with white men for 100 years.
Can I... Yeah. Can I say a weird area where that's weirdly true, since I'm sitting next to Mark?
Yeah.
So I was saying to someone that our movie was at 60% on Rotten Tomatoes,
well,
which
don't
knows
go anywhere near Rotten Tomatoes.
Is, no, no, it's the website. Thing. No, but this is very relevant to your point. And the person who said to me said, they're all men, and your fans are mainly women. And I went and I looked, and there were 40 women critics, and they gave the movie 75%. And there were 220 male critics, and they gave the movie 40%. So actually, one of the issues about movies in particular is that they tend to be reviewed by people who aren't representative of the people who are actually making the movies. And even though Christ knows what species Camilla Long is, but I think generally it would be great if there were more, if in the critical community, newspapers and everyone changed all that.
I think it's absolutely true. And I also think it's a conversation which is now finally starting. I mean, I write for The Observer, and I'm very, very lucky that on The Observer, I share the film pages with Wendy Eyde and Simran Hans. Simran, I think, is one of the youngest critics to have a national newspaper, because she's brilliant. And Wendy has been writing for many years and is a brilliant writer. And they are both better writers than I am. And actually, there are really great female film critics, and there always have been. But it is absolutely true that it is possible sometimes to look around a screening room and go, I'm a 57-year-old white bloke. What does it matter what I think? I mean, I love your movies, but you know I do. It has to change, and I think it is starting to change. But like everything else, it's really, really slow. I mean, all the way through film criticism, you know, whether it's Dennis Powell or whether it's Pauline Kael, there are these kind of great, but they have always been numerically in the minority. The problem with going to Rotten Tomatoes is twofold. Firstly, what are you doing going to Rotten Tomatoes? Just stop it. Here's how Rotten Tomatoes works, right? An aggregator machine that if one person says, this film is the best film I have ever seen, and this other person says, this film is the worst film I have ever seen, the aggregator goes, it's all right. That's literally what an aggregator does. It just turns everything into, it's all right. And secondly, you just see that numerically, it is that whole sort of swathe of people who look exactly the same. So yes, it has to change. Stop going to Rotten Tomatoes. It's bad for everybody. Oh. And support the film.
That's literally going to save me an hour a day.
Great.
But I keep on checking whether I've gone up.
And champion the critics who are saying that. I mean, like I said, like this morning I tweeted six of Simran's reviews that she wrote for The Observer. They're brilliant. They're brilliantly written. They're insightful and smart, and I don't agree with all of them. There's a film that I really like that she doesn't really like, but she writes about it in a way that makes me go, God, if I could only create a sentence that good. So it is starting to change, but it is really, really slow. People have been doing this, meaning that 5 minute, 3 minutes, so we're going to have to sort of start drawing things to a close. I just want final thoughts. Richard, being here with the film at Latitude, where it was shot, and then, is it a lovely, warm sense of, closure, and, it all got done and it worked out brilliantly and Mark loved it, so that's great.
It is lovely. I mean, one of the things that I most cherished about Danny taking on the film thing he said is, I want to spend a lot of time in Suffolk. Yeah. And I think there is a great tradition of small British movies written by people who really knew, from Gregory's Girl to Rita Sue and Bob too, people are actually writing movies. So it's a great joy to write about the place that you know and be back in the place that you know, and to hear that I think the Leyston cinema has got the highest percentage in the country for people going to see the movie. We're fighting off the Lion King with every performance. So it is very good to be back.
Yeah. Fantastic. Deborah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Do you think that things are getting better, and when can we see your film? When's it going to be released?
So it's already been released in America. It's had a limited release with Odeon here, but it's going to be released in the UK later this year, I think in the autumn.
Great.
I will let you know when. And if you could just watch it on your own time, Mark, and if you don't like it, just cross the road when you see me coming.
Okay.
That's enough. If you do like it, obviously, tell
don't
everyone.
Offer him that option. Tell him to give it a good review. Just say give it a good review, no matter his integrity that important.
If you don't
seriously
give it, if you don't give it a good review, you don't like women.
Yes. And yes.
You're not encouraging yes. women in film. I mean, yes. How's it going to change, gang? How's it going to change? Yeah. That's the thing. So, Say My Name will be out later in the year, and I will be singing about it. I'm on Twitter. I'm at Deborah FW or at Guilt Film Pod. So if you follow either of those, you'll be able to see when it comes out.
And I love it. I think it's great.
Oh, that's on the poster.
Simon?
I really like it as well. I haven't seen it yet, but I think it's fantastic.
Thank you. Great, that's on the poster, but I'll just use the bit where it says I think it's fantastic, and then I'll say Simon Armitage after some sherry, after a vat of sherry.
Simon, would you get I know, I'm sorry, I'm not meant to do this, but you're the poet laureate, it's your job. Can you bring things together with a poetic phrase? How would you like to end this session?
Oh, wow.
Something that's, it's his job.
Yeah.
6:20, speakeasy tent.
Ladies and gentlemen, Simon Armitage, Tim Frost White, Richard Curtis, thank you so much.
Thank
this
you.
Has been the Kermit on Film podcast. Enjoy Latitude.
So that was the Kermode on Film podcast, recorded live on a Sunday morning at the Latitude Festival. Hope you enjoyed it. Maybe we'll be there again next year. If you enjoyed the podcast, remember, tell your friends and subscribe. Thanks for listening.